still have difficulty with this concept of suffering. True, I mean, unfortunately, for many people, life is suffering. But we define life in general, currently as suffering.
No, that's why I really prefer not to use that word at all, because it's not really the best translation of dukkha, the word that the Buddha used, and because it's just too difficult for us to expand the meaning of that word to include the. It's a very wide-ranging and profound term, and it's just one of the normal problems of translation that you either don't translate the word and maybe alienate people or say, what's this weird word dukkha, or you use a word which is not really encompassing the full meaning of it. But one possible alternative would be, say, a lack of true happiness. So the life of unenlightened people. So there's also this, it's not life for that, it's life, the unenlightened experience of life is characterized by a lack of true happiness. So that there's a recognition, there's pleasure and there's happiness and there's fulfillment, but that it has a shadow to it, and that it's not perfect. Yes, it can be good enough, but that there is something beyond that, which can be realized, and without having to necessarily to discard all those kind of legitimate happinesses of living a good life in the world and raising a family and performing good deeds and so on and so forth. So it's like an extra dimension rather than a rejection of those kinds of normal happinesses, which I hope all of you, do experience. So, it's not saying you're not really happy, you're just kidding yourself. Really, it's just miserable, wake up, That's not really what Buddha is saying, which is often what people think. Yeah, well, it's a state. I mean, it's not a pleasant state, is it? Anguish. So we could, consider that as to be dukkha. I mean, interesting point though. Let's say, just as an exercise, I have a favorite mental exercise, I imagine conversations with a man from Mars who just arrived. He doesn't know anything about our planet. Anything about, and you have to explain various things. Why do we do it like this? What's this and what's that? So let's just, for the sake of argument, let's say our man from Mars says, "Okay, can you sum up your existence as a human being in one? If you had to, in one word, what would be the one word that you would use to sum up human existence?" You can have that's your homework, and that.
May I ask? This is just kind of wisdom. No? When you started learning Buddhism, you have different backgrounds, cultures, and did you struggle with being accepted? And now I think you are really perfect with your Buddhism, but I just wanted to know when you start learning, when you're still young, and you went through struggle with different traditions, different beliefs. And the second question, do you still apply with wisdom level of thinking even after you go with Buddhism teaching and you speak after? Or you just taught you right now to the wisdom level? I'm just curious.
I grew up in middle class family in England, which was basically secular in the family. I found no connection at all with Christianity. I found it strange and uninspiring from the age of about 8 years old. So for a number of years, I just didn't think that religion was any way necessary to life. It just seemed, I didn't think that believing in things was an answer to life in the world. In my teens, I became very interested in questions of the question I asked myself at the age of about 14 or 15 is, what's the best way to live? What's a good life? What's the best life? That was the thing that really inspired me to begin with. And then, why is the world like this? Does it have to be such a miserable place, so full of suffering and cruelty and wars and so on and so forth? And is there anything that, what's your responsibility living in a world like this? What can you do as one person? So I started reading a lot, and reading works of philosophy and psychology and literature. I was a real love to read from a child. And eventually I came across a book on Buddhism, and just immediately there's this sense of, well, obvious. It's just common sense. You know, it just made absolute sense to me. And it didn't seem in any way to be a kind of exotic Asian philosophy. But, yeah, just obvious. That was how it felt. So then I was still at high school then. So I finished high school, and I worked on a building site, saved up some money, and then I went to India and ended up traveling around in India and for nearly 2 years. And I came back to England. I didn't want to do anything except study, practice Buddhism, but I didn't quite know how to go about it. And then I went on a meditation retreat, and the teacher had been a monk in Thailand for a number of years, and so hearing about the life of monks in Thailand, I said, well, yeah, that's what I've been looking for the last 2 years. So then I came to Thailand, and I never wanted to do anything else ever since. From the day I arrived here, and that was in 1978. I don't know whether it'd be correct to distinguish Western ways of thinking and Buddhist ways of thinking. There's an overlap. I mean, on the basic techniques of critical analytical thinking, then a great deal of overlap, although the particular areas of investigation would differ. I don't think techniques of critical thinking, analytical thinking, are different or in particular. But when we're getting on to the high levels of vipassana, which is no longer using the thinking mind in the same way, then those are only accessible to someone who's practiced meditation to a certain degree. I think I still have a Western sense of humour. And I think what then.
Okay. Those words that you couldn't translate very easily into English, I'm talking about language there originally, I think it's hard. And if so, I'm not Buddhist.
Yes.
Buddha
Buddha was Indian. He was actually his birthplace is now, strictly speaking, in Nepal, in the lowlands of Nepal. Now the language, there is a certain amount of disagreement on this, but basically the language which he spoke was one of the languages spoken in the Ganges, the Indo-Gangetic Plain, northeastern India, 2,500 years ago, which has been preserved in a language called Pali, which is closely related to Sanskrit. So it's not really quite accurate, but you could perhaps compare the relationship between Pali and Sanskrit as the relationship between everyday Italian and Latin of former times, something like that. So Sanskrit was the language of the Brahmins, and it was the language of the intellectuals, and the Buddha wanted to speak the language of everyday people. English language is, I don't know, 40% Latin based probably. Thai language is something like 40-50% Pali and Sanskrit based. So you have a meeting of a Chinese tonal language and an Indian Indian language. So this is one of the difficulties of learning Thai, because all these Indian words imported into Thai have to correspond to the tonal Thai tonal system. So you can actually be speaking or reading a lot of Pali based words without realizing it, except if the spelling is a bit eccentric. Now the difficulty for Westerners approaching Buddhist terminology, it's often they're very strange and there's no clear mapping of concepts from monotheistic religious traditions onto Buddhism. So you have this dilemma as a translator, whether you borrow, say, Christian words and try to expand upon their meanings, or explain, well, this is not exactly what you understand by faith, for instance, or so on, but it's a Buddhist version. Or you keep the original, in which people find kind of alien and difficult to understand. And so, you know, of these words, dukkha and punya, which is translated as merit, you know, are good examples of, you know, everybody realizes that they're not really that good. But if you read and you study Buddhist texts more and more, at a certain point where you just sort of inject your understanding of the terms into the words, and then it becomes a lot easier. The difficulty for Thai people studying Buddhism is that a lot of the technical terms, Buddhist technical terms, imported into Thai language have, over the course of centuries, changed in meaning. And often, many Thai people will not realize that monks giving talks are using words that they're very familiar with, but in with shades of meaning which they are not familiar with. So, it's a very interesting study in the ways in which words have changed their meaning. Some of them have completely transformed. Example is the word mana in Pali, which means conceit and a sense of oneself as being superior to another, or on the same level, or inferior. And in modern Thai usage, that word is rather used to mean like to be diligent, hardworking, committed. So that's one example. And the word dukkha, similarly. For most people who don't study Buddhism, then it has a similar meaning to talk, similar meaning to in English, you know, sort of gross kind of physical pain or suffering. So, at least as a Westerner, when you meet these Buddhist technical terms, you're immediately aware that you don't really understand what they mean. The difficulty for Thai people is often is that they just assume that they know what they mean when they don't necessarily. The word sankhara has many meanings, but in Thai, sankhan, which is the Thai, just means the body, whereas in Pali it means the conditioning process, or things that are conditioned, or conditions. So if you hear the word conditions and understand it to mean body, you know, your understanding can be completely askew. Yeah, so a lot of these terms, it's a whole different, like, way of looking at things. It's something you have to very slowly kind of learn and absorb.